It's State versus Villatoro.
Good morning. May it please the court, Chris Gibson on behalf of Mrs. Leslie Villatoro. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Please. Very well.
Raised two issues on appeal, each warranting reversal of her convictions. We've challenged the sufficiency of the evidence to convict on any of the charged and prosecuted crimes. And secondly, we have challenged the way that the jury was instructed on how to deliberate. I'd like to start with the sufficiency argument and then move to the instructional issue.
You're not really challenging the accomplice instruction itself.
No.
You're simply saying that even assuming that that's a correct statement of the law, that there's insufficient evidence on any of the elements? I mean, any of the charged crimes?
On any of the charged crimes. The problem here is, obviously it's a very liberal standard. We admit the truth of all the evidence that was submitted, and we take all reasonable inferences in favor of the state. But even under that liberal standard here, you cannot find, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Leslie Villatoro had advanced knowledge of what Mr. Horn was going to do, and that she was ready to assist. Now, there is plenty of evidence that they lived together, they did lots of things together, they purchased items together, but it requires speculation and conjecture to get from that evidence. And if you look, I think the state's issue statement, number one issue statement on page one of its brief, it's about a page-long single sentence outlining everything they have to present against Mrs. Villatoro. And even reading through that, I don't see how you come to the determination that she knew what was going on and was ready to assist, at least enough to get over the presumption of innocence.
Well, circumstantial evidence can convict, right?
Absolutely.
And there may be a distinction, at least I assume the state would take the position, there's a distinction between circumstantial evidence, I think they say that this is a circumstantial case, and mere speculation. So explain to us why this is not a circumstantial case.
Well, it is an evidence presented with circumstantial evidence. That's the only thing they really have against Leslie's involvement in this alleged incident. The problem is that even if you combine bits of information, for example, maybe the most damning fact against her was the fact that she drove Mr. Horn to the cul-de-sac, where he then entered the home and committed the crimes that he committed.
And she waited there.
She did not wait in the cul-de-sac. She went to a park. Now,
wasn't it nearby?
It was about 3 minutes away.
Okay,
very close,
so she was waiting while he did whatever he did. Was he dressed all in black when he was in the car?
That's what she testified, yes.
And
but it was the middle of the day. I mean, if he were dressed in black and it were night out, maybe that would be an indicator that he's off to go do something.
And what about the duffel bag with the...
The murder kit?
Yes.
She knew he'd put a duffel bag in. She didn't know it was a murder kit. That's a term come up with by the state. So she knew he had a duffel bag in the back. She didn't know what he took out of the back. I mean, there are lots of ways to think, maybe she didn't know something going on here. But there's a lot of maybes. There's a lot of hunch evidence here, if you will. And that's just not sufficient to get over the presumption of innocence and convict her of these crimes beyond a reasonable doubt. Rocky Chavarro, however you pronounce his last name, Rocky was more tied to these crimes than Leslie Villatoro was, and he was never even prosecuted. That's a different issue. Urge this court to parse through all of the evidence presented in this case and find at the end you cannot get to actual knowledge and intent to assist. I'd like to move to the instructional issue.
Well, the first question is, this was not requested below. Why should we hear it?
Because this is a constitutional issue. This
well, not just a constitution. You have to wrap 2.5a. Why is it manifest?
It is manifest constitutional error because, as the Supreme Court in Lamar has held, the verdicts reached during deliberations need to be the common experience of all of them. That means jurors have to deliberate together.
Well, in Lamar, there was evidence in the record about going afoul of that standard. What evidence in this record is equivalent to that in Lamar that would allow us to reach the issue?
And the Lamar case dealt with the replacement of an alternate juror. And in fact, that's what we had in this case also. We had an alternate juror replaced. And in fact, the court gave the CRR 6.5 admonishment. And that's fine. It tells you you all need to start deliberating together. But what has never happened, whether it was the original jury or the reconstituted jury, was how to conduct those deliberations in a constitutionally correct manner, which is all together. There are courts all over this state not getting that advice.
Well, we're focusing on this court in this circumstance, and I still don't understand why the claimed error is manifest in this situation.
Because just as in the juror replacement cases, where we say, well, we didn't tell them they had to deliberate anew, so they, and we can't get in there and look at their actual deliberations, these courts assume that that was error because the new juror didn't benefit from the deliberations of all the others. It's because we can't be confident that the verdict produced was through proper deliberation.
But we don't have that circumstance.
Yes, we do, because we do not have a jury that was correctly told how to deliberate.
No, we have a circumstance here where the judge correctly instructed the jury to begin deliberations anew with the new juror. So the premise of your argument then doesn't apply. So, again, back to Judge Cox's question, why is this manifest in this case?
Well, I would suggest it still applies here, because just as you can't be confident in that the deliberations were proper in a reconstituted jury,
which we don't have here.
Well, we can't have confidence in any of the jury deliberations, whether they were before or after the reconstituting, because we assume juries follow the instructions given by the court. There is no opposite one, or maybe there is an opposite. We can't assume they follow instructions not given. And here you have a jury never told how to properly deliberate. I'd like to read very quickly what the court should do. And, in fact, courts in Pierce County routinely give this instruction.
Is this in the record?
It is not, but I've provided Ms. Hillary a copy of this.
All right,
just an example of what should be said. Obviously, now that all the evidence has been received, you can and must discuss the case in the jury deliberation room. That is the only place to discuss the case. Jury deliberations is a group process. You should only discuss the case when all 12 jurors are seated at the table or present in the jury room. You should not discuss the case separately, such as by telephoning each other over the weekend or making contact in any other way or at night. You should not discuss the case during lunch or during the break. That's the instruction that needs to be given to every deliberating jury in Washington, and it's not happening. It's a serious problem. This court, I think, needs to take a close look at this issue and see that, in fact, this results in prejudice to the client. And I've also alerted Ms. Thomas that there is an advancement in this argument making it a structural error issue, and it's comparable to failing to give a proper reasonable doubt instruction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Bear with me. It's the first time I'm trying this technology.
Don't expect help from us.
There we go. Okay. First of all, I wanted to apologize to the court and to counsel. In looking at my Appendix B, I realized that I mistakenly omitted instruction number 15, which was the attempted murder charge, and then instruction number 27, which contained the elements of the first-degree robbery. Those should have been included in that appendix. As Your Honors are well aware, the standard for the sufficiency of the evidence is whether any rational trier of fact could find the elements beyond reasonable doubt, and all the inferences need be drawn in favor of the state and most strongly against the defense. And the federal courts have characterized this sometimes about whether or not the jury's finding was so insupportable as to fall below the threshold of bare rationality. In this case, I just wanted to briefly, I think sometimes it helps to have a picture of exactly what happened and what close mile radius or so that this happened in. So here we have the victim's house, and that's where she is attacked in the house, and then the horn leaves with her vehicle, and the neighbor says that he sees the vehicle going in a direction that would take them straight by Michael Moore Park, which is right here on the corner, and that's where she, Ms. Villatoro, says that she's waiting for him initially, and that she allows the kids to play there. And then he comes out here, he goes down, and he goes over.
where presumably he meets up with Rocky. Whoops. Comes over here. This is the Herco buildings right here. This is where they pinpoint the first cell phone call is made, the Hope's phone call. And then within a short period of time, just a mere matter of minutes, I think it's 6 minutes, the second, Hope's phone call is made that his is actually his voice and it's identified as his voice. And then the fire aid person sees him in this vehicle or sees the vehicle in this location within about 3 minutes thereafter, and he drives very slowly back down this way, and Horn pulls in for whatever reason behind him and is following the aid vehicle as the aid vehicle is going down Smith Road.
Is that Interstate 5?
That's Interstate 5, yes. And so instead of following the aid vehicle, which he sees is going down Smith Road, which is right back towards where the victim's house is, he goes up LaBounty Road, follows up here, and goes up into this, and waits in this, waits up here near Main Street, where the Blaine police chief then comes up behind him and is sitting there, but doesn't realize that that's who that is. So then he gets back on the road, then there's another sheriff's vehicle that identifies this car, and then they do the car chase, and he purposely drives right back down across Smith Road, could have chosen some other way to go, and he goes right past Michael Moore Park again, and he goes right past Good Shepherd Church, and then he is, and then they do the pit maneuver here, and where he stopped. So I just wanted to provide a brief overview of where all this took place and how close it was with
To one another, all the events. Back to the reasonable inferences. So with respect to accomplice liability, we're talking about the liability for the attempted murder, kidnapping, robbery, and burglary, and the state did not need to prove all the individual elements or that she had knowledge of all the individual elements of those individual crimes, but just simply attempted murder, burglary, kidnapping, and robbery.
But don't Cronin and Roberts stand for the proposition that it may not be all elements, but as to each crime?
As to each crime and the crime. And so when they're talking about robbery, they're talking about let's say the charge is robbery in the first degree, then you're talking about robbery. So there has to be an unlawful taking by threat of force. But that we don't have to actually prove the degree of the crime. So
that's your second statement of authorities that you were submitting.
Yes, yes, and I did want to indicate to the court that I did submit a additional authority with respect to that. The Horn had a very clear plan here. It was very planned out, and it involved Villatoro's absolute assistance. She knew that her actions would facilitate Horn's committing these offenses. By the fact that she took the items, or she drove him in the car with the items that were in the black duffel bag that include the flex cuffs, that include the hunting knife, that included the ammunition for the gun, the duct tape. And then she saw that when he got into the car that he was dressed all in black. She told one of the detectives she saw him bring the duffel bag into the car, although she claimed she didn't see him take it out of the car. She drove him right in front of the victim's house, essentially. And then she left there, and she stayed in the area and went just down the road about 30 seconds by car. And she had in the car at that time the police scanner, a change of clothes for him, his normal clothes, the white shirt and shorts, and a gas can, the bleach, which were obviously going to be used to destroy the evidence of his involvement in the crime. And
or at least the jury could so believe.
Yes, the jury certainly could draw that. That's a reasonable inference. And then Horn purposely drove by the church parking lot, and then when he knew that he was in trouble, he was being chased by the police, and she says that when she heard the sirens, that's when she left the church parking lot, even though she hadn't even waited the full 30 minutes minutes that she had indicated to him that she would wait there before leaving.
So time is short on the instruction issue.
Yes.
What's your position as to the arguments that's being made that this is structural error?
With respect to the jury unanimity?
Yes.
Your Honor, I would appreciate an opportunity to address that. I don't think that this should be dealt in any other manner than a jury unanimity issue would be addressed. I don't think that there's any evidence in this record whatsoever to indicate that there was any issue with respect to the jury not obeying the directions of the court to begin to deliberate anew and not to take into consideration.
No, I think the argument, though, is there's not a specific instruction as to deliberating together at the same time in the jury room.
Correct. No, I understand that that's the argument. There's never been a case that says that there has to be. There's no WIPIC that says that there has to be. This would not have been manifest to the trial court. The trial court wouldn't have known that they were supposed to instruct the jury that, you know, whenever you take a bathroom break, you have to stop your deliberations. And the jury is presumed to follow the instructions that were given. And, in fact, the court indicated that it could tell from the jurors' expressions that they didn't really want to deliberate anew. And then you do have the polling that indicated that the jury was unanimous. And so there's nothing in the record to indicate whatsoever that the jury did not collectively deliberate at all times before this court. I would presume that almost every single conviction would have to be overturned because there's no WIPIC out there, I guess, aside from Pierce County, that requires any of this kind of instruction before. So I do not have a response with respect to the structural error argument, and I would rely upon my brief for the rest of the discussion regarding that. I would be happy to provide the court supplemental briefing, though, with respect to the structural error if it so chooses.
It's up to you.
Okay, thank you.
I don't think appellant raised that in his brief.
He did not.
Did not.
No. That's why I didn't address it in my brief. So with respect to whether or not she knew what was in the duffel bag, she had purchased the duffel bag when she purchased the gas can. They clearly had a communication at the time that she was at Walmart, and he asked, are you going to get the other stuff? And so, and she said yes. She lied about the black duffel bag to the officers. The jury was entitled to not believe her statements that she didn't know what was in the duffel bag. She initially stammered when she was asked what else Horn had bought at Walmart 2 days before. She denied he had bought a duffel bag, but she volunteered information that Horn had a blue one that was home and that she had one. And then in response to the question, any other duffel bags? She responded, I don't think so, even though she had bought one and been present when Horn had also bought one, and that she had told the one of the detectives that he had put a duffel bag in the trunk. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, counsel.
I'd like to return to the instructional issue, and I have not raised structural error in this case. I was just alerting the court that that issue has developed in some recent filings. This issue is pending.
What does that mean?
Well, I've added.
Developed in some recent filings.
In other cases, I've been filing this issue, and I have raised a structural error argument. And so I am willing, if the court wants to provide supplemental briefing on this issue. I'm just alerting the court that that's where this issue is going, and it is pending before the Supreme Court in a petition as drafted in this case.
I don't believe this panel is asking you to provide anything that isn't already in the briefing.
Okay.
It's up to you, though.
All right. I would urge this court, I'll go back to the prejudice issue, and if this court looks at the Lamar decision and this court's decisions in Blankaflor, Stanley, and Ashcraft. In each of those cases, this court was looking at, you have a jury that was ignorant about how to proceed with proper deliberations. And that's what you've got in every case out there where this instruction from Pierce County Judge Edmund Murphy is not being given. There are other judges out there giving. I'm not raising it in every appeal I'm raising, but I think if this court looks into the issue, it's going to find Washington has a serious problem with its pattern jury instructions. It doesn't have what's needed to make sure that the verdicts are constitutionally unanimous. And it needs to get fixed. For whatever reason, judges in some counties, maybe they're instructed through classes.
Well, so if it's a better practice, why not just ask the committee to?
I agree. I think that needs to get done. But it's not just a better practice. It's constitutionally required. Article 1, Section 22 and 21 have been interpreted to say this is how verdicts must be reached through deliberations that are the common experience of all. And if anybody's ever been on a jury, they know how we assume that they're going to follow in the instructions given. They don't, but we assume they do. But we can't assume that they're going to follow an instruction on how to properly deliberate that's never given.
But to go back to Judge Cox's earlier question, there's no facts presented in this case that would show there is a manifest error as to this. In other words, there was the juror who got ill and was replaced, but then the court properly instructed us to begin again.
Yes, that was proper, begin again, but there was still never an indication that during those new deliberations, don't deliberate when somebody leaves the room. Stop your deliberations. That's the problem here. And the prejudice in the record is the lack of being properly instructed on how to deliberate. So we can't assume they did it properly. That's the problem. It's a serious problem, and I ask this court reverse on both grounds. But if you don't, on the sufficiency of the evidence, certainly reverse and remand on the instructional issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.